Hey, how's it going, everybody? This is Chris. Welcome to episode 42 of NML Crossing, where, for the first time in a little while, we're going to try and have us a normal episode of this program. Normal, with, I guess, using whatever definition we use for normal here. But we're going to talk about an issue. We're going to do mail. It took the entire week to get here, but I'm glad we're finally here. It was a hell of a week, and I'm very, very pleased that it's in the rear view, and we're on to different things. I'm actually going to be moving house over the course of the next month, probably month and a half. I'm going to be doing most of the move myself, you know, one car load at a time. We're not moving far. We're moving back to a house we used to live in, not too far from where we're currently staying, but it's time to go home, and I cannot wait for this chapter to be closed. Anyway, nobody cares about that. How about we get into today's book here? We're going to be looking at Batman number 561. Which had a January 1999 cover date. Story is called Either Mr. Wayne Goes to Washington or Bruce Wayne Goes to Washington, Part 2, The Witness. Written by Chuck Dixon with pencils by Jim Aparo, inks David Roach, letters Todd Klein, colors Lee Lowridge, edits Gorfinkel O'Neill, cover price one penny shy of $2. Now, we open and we're in the high court. And we got Bruce Wayne introducing himself to the panel of U.S. senators who were serving as the Board of Review for the plea to rebuild Gotham City. And there's a bit of a gimmick in this issue. Every other page is a full-page spread, which shows something Gotham-y, or perhaps batty, in order to punctuate whatever point Bruce is trying to make on the stand. Now, he opens with some pretty hard facts about Gotham. And basically saying this isn't going to be easy, this ain't going to be cheap, and there are 7 million lives at stake here. And, Gotham isn't exactly something out of a fairy tale. He refers to it as a hard luck town, which might be underselling it just a tad. He says it's dark and it casts deep shadows, and as he says this, we get a full-page spread of... pearls scattered in the alley. We can never go too long without getting one of those scenes, can we? But I guess it does punctuate his point. Now, he talks about how the tragedies of Gotham make it like an anvil, which tempers its people into a tough breed. He recounts how the Wayne families lived in Gotham for 2 centuries now, and how it was there that they built themselves into a financial giant. But they couldn't do it alone. It was only with the help from uncountable Gothamites that they could succeed. He then goes into the weeds a bit, claiming that Gotham inspires its citizens via fear? Or maybe something even darker than fear? I don't think you want to... Okay. Now, this point is punctuated by that scene out of Year One where the bat crashes through the window at Wayne Manor. So I guess that's the inspiration. Now, while Bruce relitigates the grit of Gothamites, we take a tour of various friends and folks who are watching this all play out on television. We see Alfred, Gordon, Bullock, and Montoya from the GCPD, we see Babs, we got Tim, they're all watching or reacting or, well, you know, maybe reacting is too strong a word for it. They're watching it, and they really don't have much of an expression on their face as they do. Bruce talks up how Gotham can usually step up and save itself, even when faced with seemingly insurmountable odds. Now, this is punctuated by a page of Batman saving a woman from some gang types in an alley. Now, while Gotham can usually help itself, this time, well, this is a little extreme, it's a little different. This time, they need to ask their fellow Americans for a hand up. He promises that Gotham will pay the country back for any sacrifices it makes in their name. And he's so sure about this, he's willing to stake his entire fortune on it. With that, he ends his plea and sits down. The floor is now open, and the first person to speak up is Senator Barclay Means, who we met last issue. Now, he attempts to educate Bruce as to the reputation that Gotham City currently has. Gotham is seen as an asylum. To quote Means here, he says, it's a nightmare carnival ride and a haven for the worst of the worst. Now, this point is punctuated by a shot of the Batman Rogues Gallery. Now, Means makes an allusion to certain urban legends in Gotham, and he assures Bruce that its bad reputation is anything but an urban legend. He then goes into statistics. Violent crime has continually risen across the board in Gotham, where in the rest of the country it's gone down. And currently, the Gotham City Police Force is in a state of disarray and wildly understaffed, to say the very least. He says that the cost to the American people for the rebuild of Gotham will be in the trillions of dollars over the next couple of decades. Now, Bruce takes issue with that. Well, the Gotham is a haven to the worst of the worst bit, because he can't really argue anything else. He points out that there are saints in this city of sinners, and how those are the real Gotham City. Means he takes a different tack here, suggesting that perhaps Bruce isn't here out of simple altruism and a love for his hometown. Perhaps there's something a little bit more material to his impassioned plea. Bruce makes the mistake of asking for clarification, because come on, dude, why would you ask for more information here? Means points out that Wayne has billions and billions in assets in Gotham, and he wonders aloud if Bruce isn't just there to protect his own financial interests. Well, the very suggestion starts to get Bruce a little bit rankled. He points out how every non-Wayne corporation has already abandoned Gotham, and how, if it were up to his financial advisors, he'd have done the same. He goes on to suggest that maybe his undying love of his hometown is a demon he wrestles with emphasis on demon, because he then asks Means if he knows anything about demons. Now, this has the senator pretty shaken. Now, to remove any subtlety from the scene, we take a beat to check in with Nick Scratch's trio of devilheads, who are also watching this on their black and white TV. What year is this? Why does everybody only have black and white TVs? It's worth noting the devilheads are still fully masked, which is kind of ridiculous, but I suppose understandable so we can identify them at sight. Now, while Bruce rattles on about demons, we, for some reason, go to that sort of iconic scene of a shirtless Batman crossing swords with Ra's al Ghul in the desert. Why? Oh, well. Whatever the case, it works to shut Means up, and he gives us the whole no further questions sort of spoo. But now we get some word from another panelist, perhaps another senator. I don't know if we got a name or not here. Anyway, he points out that Bruce himself just pointed out that it's probably a bad idea for him to keep his corporations in Gotham. Which, I mean, dude's got a point. Bruce might have unwittingly been arguing against his own plea. He then points out how Bruce Wayne just now bought up a whole lot of ruined areas of Gotham. Bruce admits this to be true, but he says he only did so in order to help homeowners and small businesses. Well, touche. But, the senator points out, that if the United States government does bail Gotham City out, all of those decimated neighborhoods are going to skyrocket in value, which would only serve to line Wayne's already wildly fat pockets. Bruce then goes into a sort of aimless bid to suggest that he's had many setbacks in life, which, I mean, we as readers, we're all privy to that, right? Like, we know everything he's done as Batman. But to the average American citizen in the DCU, or worse yet, the average Gothamite, this is such an insanely tone-deaf statement. Now, this point is punctuated by the scene of Bane breaking Batman's back. Which, again, that's something we know about. But on Capitol Hill, Bruce just sounds like an out-of-touch asshole at this point. One of the richest men on the planet talking about the setbacks he's had when people... his entire city is basically homeless right now. Very out of touch. He then pitches his own self-funded Gotham Redevelopment Corporation. He claims that he and Lucius Fox put this together as a publicly traded entity that will help to lessen the impact of the rebuild on the American taxpayer. which, if true, maybe he should have opened with this idea? Because saying it now just seems desperate. Also a bit disingenuous, if not completely fabricated. To further punctuate that, we see Lucius Fox's reaction to this bit, wherein he admits that this is not a plan that could ever work, but he admires Bruce's attempt to sell it anyway. Bruce then recounts all the recent trauma that Gotham's endured and how her people keep on keeping on. You know, not counting the, millions of Gothamites who have already boogied on out. Bruce then goes on the offensive, which is probably not in his best interests. He suggests that the money to help Gotham is there, and it's just a matter of prioritizing it. He starts making demands of the panel, which... Bruce... I'm having a hard time believing that Bruce is Batman here, because he's just coming across so woefully unprepared for this entire debacle here. He tells the people on the panel to cut some subsidy programs. He tells them to shut down useless departments and to trim up the redundancy in government, which, duh, could and probably should be done. But would you ever expect your government to actually do something that would benefit the common folk? I mean, maybe we can get them to stop voting to give themselves raises for working 20 days a year while we're at it. You know, maybe we do that first and then we worry about dumping trillions of dollars into a city that nobody wants around. I don't know. Bruce's mic drop moment is kind of flat. He just tells the panel to find the money, and if they don't or won't, he hopes they can live with themselves. He then just gets up and leaves. Nobody dismissed him. Nobody banged a gavel. He just gets up and leaves. We close out with Bruce on the stairs, where he's surrounded by reporters all hoping to get a statement. And he says he'll take one question. The question is, why do you care about Gotham? Oh boy, why do you care about Gotham so much? He replies that a long time ago, he made a promise. And we end with a shot of Batman standing in Crime Alley where his parents were murdered all those years ago. Whew. That's where we leave it. Next, we wrap up Mr. Wayne Goes to Washington in Batman 562. We get no letters page, so we don't get a little pick-me-up between the synopsis and the discussion. So I guess let's hop right in. This story, I don't know. I'm really thinking I overhyped it in my own mind, because I'm coming away from it wildly underwhelmed. I was just expecting more for such an important arc, and I mean a seminal arc for the entire No Man's Land era. It's just kind of it feels like an afterthought. There just really isn't any drama here. And I mean, there is a fun little back and forth between Bruce and the senators here, but definitely not what I'd prepared myself for, not what I was expecting. And like, my main takeaway here is Bruce is coming off really, really bad here. Like, completely tone deaf, totally out of touch. And like I mentioned during the synopsis here, I'm actually struggling to reconcile that this man is also Batman. Unless he's just incredibly frazzled by the quake and the aftermath, this is just a real doofy-looking Bruce. Everything the panel is saying about Bruce seems true. Gotham City being bailed out would greatly benefit Bruce Wayne, right? And it kind of taints any sort of impassioned plea that he could ever deliver. Everything he says is now filtered through this lens of, like, what he will personally be getting out of it. It makes him look like probably the worst person to be speaking on Gotham City's behalf, doesn't it? Though, maybe that was the plan all along, right? Maybe the senators were trying to give Gotham equal time, and they picked the worst advocate for the city. Just someone who won't resonate with the common people, and who will look like he's going to be benefiting personally from these, you know, the government moving money around. It's very weird. In addition to that, there was that bit where he was talking to Senator Means, and he mentions demons. You know, I mean, the way Means was visibly shaken, like literally drawn with those shaky lines around him, so you know that this affected him deeply. So you might assume that he knows that Bruce knows about his devil-headed protectors the other night, which might suggest that Bruce is Batman. Maybe I'm reaching here. I might be. I mean, because of course we are outsiders looking in. We have much more of a unfiltered lens that we're looking at this through, right? But, I mean, for real, Bruce nor Batman are really ever in Washington, D.C., except for right this minute. I don't know. It just came off as not quite right. And Bruce just doesn't seem like he would taunt someone like that. Like, it's like, I don't know, it feels like you're spilling a lot of beans there. And yet, here he is, he's calling out demons when, I don't know. This didn't land for me. You know, I can't lie, this arc has been a pretty big letdown for me, and that's kind of heartbreaking, because I was looking forward to this one for a long time. I'd never read this one. I knew that it was, like, the seminal arc, and I just couldn't wait. Like, this was a run of books here. These three issues of Batman were books that I wanted to cheat and, like, jump ahead and read. Because, you know, the covers look cool. The covers tell a story, and we know what we're getting into, and you just figure, like, everything's going to fall into place here, and it's going to be great, and it's going to be dramatic. And it wasn't. It just wasn't. And I mean, and it's Chuck Dixon, who we've been raving about since we started the show. And it just doesn't work. I think, like, the only good thing I can say about it is that Nicholas Scratch didn't show up. I mean, his devil heads did, but he didn't. I guess that's... I guess we'll take that as the win for today, because, yeah, this is, unfortunately, a bit of a letdown. I don't know if these were written in haste. Like, it's like, okay, well, we know what we're doing now. Let's get it going here. Doug Mensch has walked off the job, so we need to fill space for the next few months. Maybe that's what happened. Maybe I'm thinking too hard about it. Or maybe I'm just completely off base. I'll have to leave that for you to let me know if I'm being a little too persnickety about this one. I do have that in me sometimes. I will nitpick at the silliest things. So if that's what I'm doing here, please don't hesitate to let me know. On that subject, how about we hop into the NML bag? It's been quite a bit here, and we have a lot of letters, and we're going to try to work through them. I grabbed just a handful of them here. To chat up. We're going to start with our friend Billy D talking about Asriel. We have a lot of Asriel chat here today. He says, wow, don't get me wrong. Denny's a legend, but he was obviously way past his prime at this point. It's almost like watching a Sunday Beer League softball game. It was awful. And yeah, it's like we were saying when we were talking about that Asriel run. And I mean, we still have a lot of Asriel to get through, including more Nick Scratch in Asriel, which... I'm kind of looking forward. It's like I'm dreading and looking forward to it. It's one of those things. But yeah, Denny he's done so much for the industry, and it feels wrong to point out that something he wrote isn't all that great. You know, it just doesn't. It's like it reminds me of like when you'd get like a Stan Lee story in the mid 2000s, and it would just be like, oh, it's Stan. You know, like it would never be great, but it's still Stan, and you don't wanna poo-poo something that someone so special put out, and you get those weird sort of conflicts inside there. Billy continues. He goes, as far as comics and their preservation, I use bags and boards, and I use two small pieces of tape on both sides to hold it down. My collection's in all short boxes, some regular, some drawer boxes, and in piles along with trades, as I've run out of shelf space and box space. And that is always a big problem, isn't it? Like right now we're doing this move, and like I'm so excited to go back to my old bookshelves here, but in the time we've been away, because we haven't lived in that house for about 3 years now, and we never emptied it out. We meant to many times, but we didn't. So like my bookshelves are over there, but you know, back when we still lived there, I'd already outgrown the bookshelves. So 3 years later, it's gonna be tough to try to set things up again, because I happen to choose like the one bookshelf at IKEA that they discontinued, which sucks. I think it was like, it isn't the, ironically enough, it wasn't the Billy bookcase. That's like the one, that's like their, like the IKEA bookcase. Mine was like the Kilby, because I think it was like half the price of the Billy bookcases, and I'm notoriously cheap with most things. So I have like four of them, full-size bookshelves, and I can't find, and I'm also very anal, as you could probably tell. So I want everything to match. So for like the past 10, 15 years, I've been like bargaining with myself about getting rid of my bookcases and just starting new, starting fresh, maybe doing built-ins or whatever. But it makes me second guess every trade or hardcover that I buy, because it's like I've got nowhere to put it. Boxes, of course, you could just pick up boxes anywhere, or hopefully. With boxes, we've been doing this like weird famine to feast thing, at least locally, where like I could go to every shop in town and they're like, nope, don't have boxes. Haven't had boxes in months. Don't know when they're coming back. And then I'll go like a month later and every shop in town has dozens and dozens of boxes, like to the point where they can't give them away. It's very weird stuff. And here's a question here. How are boxes priced where you guys live? I remember like short boxes used to be like $3 and long boxes used to be like $5.99. Now long boxes are like $12. It's like, good grief. And drawer boxes, forget about it. I don't know how much those things cost. I've done a few like mock orders of those online, because sometimes I get a wild hair to do it and it's like, okay, I'll order, because I think a long drawer box holds a little bit less than a regular long box because of the spacing and whatever. So it's like, okay, I'm going to need like 120 of them. And I'll put the order in and it'll be however much it's going to be. And then it's like, okay, I can do that. Fine. Whatever. Then I get to the shipping and it's like the entire cost of the boxes plus like 30%. So like for easy numbers, say it's $1,000 for the boxes. Shipping is going to be $1,300 on top of that. And it's like, okay, never mind. I can't swing that. But, the dream would be to have, you know, a wall of drawer boxes. That would be phenomenal. I think that would make me very, very giddy to have that, just to be able to access everything, not have to move things around. It would just be really, really amazing. And I mean, a lot of my friends, you know, Billy included, they use short boxes. I know my back would thank me for having short ones, but I just got in too deep with the long boxes, you know? I think when I hit like 30 or 40 of them, it was just like, well, crap, I need to keep everything uniform. So it was just more and more long boxes, to the point where I have the disaster that I'm currently looking at right this very moment. Billy wraps up with, good to hear from Bailey. Take care and keep on rolling, Chris. And yes, it was very, very great to hear from our friend Chris Bailey here. I mentioned during his mail how much I miss talking to him and our weekly, you know, moratory powwows, and it's a real, real good time, a real real bright point in my life when we were doing that, and I definitely miss those days. But thank you so much for writing in, Billy, and also for when we were talking about Asriel, I was afraid that I was falling into that angry reviewer sort of mindset where it's like I'm just like ragging on something to rag on it. I'm glad to see that that wasn't the case. That so far, it's unanimous. People did not think the Asriel Nick Scratch story was all that great. So that makes me feel a little bit less insane. And that's a good thing. That's a good thing. Next up, we've got our friend Eric, who says, I'd wanted to comment on how the No Man's Land stories are great because it just stays within the Bat family without any Justice League involvement. This was a time in comics where I felt you could still read a series and not feel like it had to involve the entire connected DC universe. This might be because today we get so many events, guest star issues, and tie-in issues during solo series that make it feel like we constantly are just reading a Justice League level event. This was a time when most heroes stayed in their own city unless the hero asked for help. While I understand the superheroes could have helped find survivors and rebuild, Superman could have just picked up the Davenport building and made it stand up, but would it have made it structurally sound? How long was Flash going to keep up trying to rebuild everything? Green Lantern may create a construct to clear some debris. All I'm saying is, in the 15 seconds of the quake, what could the superheroes actually have done to stop the destruction? Afterward, it still would have been a big cleanup. They wouldn't have been able to just place toppled buildings back in place. And that's a wonderful point. That's a great point because I feel like, and this goes into the Usenet discussions here. People were talking about how the Justice League could fix this like that, you know, where when you stop to think about it, no, they couldn't, right? You know, Superman can lift buildings and set them down, but who would ever want to get back in that building, you know? We've seen Green Lanterns try to rebuild cities, and that didn't work out well. So, maybe... Because the thing that they said on Usenet all the time was about the internal logic. How No Man's Land didn't work because it didn't have internal logic. Or it wasn't internally logical within the greater DC universe, because this would never happen. But, hell, what if we had the Justice League in there right now? What could they have done? Right? If you stop to think about it, sure, we can hand wave it away. We can maybe bring in Zatanna to say something backwards and make everything go back to normal. But in the heat of it, there really isn't a whole heck of a lot that can be done. You know, it's a city was decimated. And sure, the Justice League could help, but they couldn't just, you know, wriggle their nose and make it all good again. So even with Justice League involvement, this was going to be an uphill battle. So taking the Justice League out of it and letting us focus on the, you know, the Bat family of characters, like we've said from the start, this is the way the story needed to be told. Right? You don't need to bring the gods in. This is a city story about a city, you know? It's a city story about people who live in a city who are trying to rebuild. And that's what makes it so special. You know, of course, when we get toward the end of it, there's going to be some outsiders getting involved, but it's all going to work. As far as I remember, it's all going to work. And it's going to lead us to maybe talking about something else after NML Crossing is through. But we'll get there when we get there, if we get there. We will keep our fingers crossed. Back to Eric, he says, in regards to recent conversations about leaving comics and restarting in the hobby again, I started by reading the X-Men comics in the 90s. I enjoyed the comics and art a lot, and then I added Uncanny X-Men. Unless it was a crossover, I did not read X-Factor, X-Force, Excalibur, or Wolverine. I just stuck to the two main titles. But then we got the Phalanx Covenant and Generation X. I don't know what happened, but I remember getting a little overwhelmed by all the X titles. The Age of Apocalypse was about to start, and I just quit. I wasn't interested anymore. So I moved on to Spider-Man, and I collected all four Spider-Man titles. I was enjoying the stories, but then we got to the Clone Saga. I remember two things made me quit Spider-Man at this point. One was the change to all Spider-Man's villains. For example, Doc Ock became female, and they had some new version of Kraven, among many others. The other thing was the revival of Norman Osborn. This is the first time he was back from being killed, and I just got annoyed and walked away completely from comics. It was about 20 years before I went back to comics. I read some stuff on the Marvel Unlimited app to catch up with Spider-Man and the X-Men. Some stuff was enjoyable to read, but as I got closer to the current day, I noticed two things. One, the stories were getting less interesting, and two, every Marvel book felt like I was reading an Avengers or an entire connected Marvel Universe book instead of a solo title. It may have just been because of the success of the Marvel movies, multiple crossovers, and all the guest stars. I quit Spider-Man, that wasn't going anywhere, but I stuck with the X-Men. However, I got frustrated again in the X-Men because every other scene, someone was getting stabbed or killed, only to be revived or alive a panel or page later. It was like the X-Men had no skills at fighting anymore. This was also when we started getting multiple titles that would last at most 12 to 20 issues. Cyclops was also a villain at this time, so they'd changed Magneto's name and origin again. Old Man Logan was on the team. I got tired of fake deaths every issue and I quit. I moved over to DC Comics and started reading Batman and other heroes. Batman would become the one I enjoyed the most, and I've been there ever since. Now, that was a lot to take in there, but your trajectory through the fandom and hobby is, there's a lot of parallels with mine, and I mean, I've told these stories probably too many times, but I came into it, you know, I came into it starting with ElfQuest. That's how I started that's the first time I went to a comic book store. Once there, I was introduced to the X-Men and just, you know, totally fell in love with the line of books here. My books were Uncanny, X-Men Volume 2, X-Force, and X-Factor. They were $1.25 each when I started. And so for an entire month's worth of books, I paid $5, you know. Can you imagine that? $5 for your entire month's worth of reading. And I stuck with it through the Age of Apocalypse. I did stay for the Age of Apocalypse. But I wound up quitting because of gimmick covers. Gimmick covers I understand, you know, when you have, because back then we would celebrate every 25th issue, of course, and certain anniversaries we would celebrate. But we got to the point where we were celebrating random things just as an excuse to throw some foil on a cover. And I remember going to the store, and I've told this story before. I went to the store to buy X-Men Volume 2, number 45. It's a wonderful issue. A really, really good issue. Fabian Nicieza, it might have been his last issue, but it was a wonderful, wonderful issue. But I got there with my... I think the books were like $2 at that point because they were the Marvel Deluxe or whatever, like in that really terrible glossy paper. So I went there with my $2, and it was not to be because this was a foil cover, and it was $4. And something in my head clicked, and I was just like, okay, I can't, I'm done. I'm done. Because I asked why. I asked the guy at the shop why this one was, you know, foil and oversized and overpriced. And he's like, oh, it's the 20th anniversary of Giant Size Number 1. I'm like, okay, so? You know? It's like, it just made me realize that they can celebrate any anniversary. You know, it's like, oh, it was 18 and a half years since Wolverine said bub, so every book's going to be $8 this month. It just really took me out of it. And I walked away for about 2 years at that point. I just couldn't do it anymore. And, of course, you know, I came back. You mentioned here that coming back to comics, especially the Marvel books, they were a little bit different when he came back 20 years later. And I can agree with that because I left Marvel around the same time you did. If my internal calendar's right, I'm guessing with Old Man Logan on the team, Cyclops is a villain, you're probably talking 2015, 2016-ish. That's when I finally quit. It was the X-Men, you know, gold and blue teams, and we still had the original five that were time displaced by Bendis, and it was just not great. It felt very much like an afterthought. It felt like the fulfillment of a contract. Like, okay, we need to have this X book out. Here it is. Choke on it. You know, and we did, because it was terrible. Like I've said, not too long ago, that was the first time that, like, I was still collecting comics, but not X-Men. You know, I kept buying other stuff, but I dropped every single X-book, and I'd never done that before. Usually when I walked away cold, like everything done, or I was just too broke to afford everything, so I bought nothing. You know, this time, though, I was still getting my monthly order. I was still getting Marvel books. I was still getting DC books, but I dropped all the X-Men books because, like you said, they were not great. And every single issue felt like we were reading the Avengers guest starring the X-Men. I don't remember which volume of Uncanny it was. And I mean, I talk a lot and I generally tune myself out. So if I'm repeating myself, I apologize. But there was a volume of Uncanny X-Men that started with like 12 pages of S.H.I.E.L.D. talking about everything going on in the Marvel Universe. And it's like, I'm reading Uncanny X-Men number one, and I'm getting a lecture from Maria Hill about what the Avengers are doing. What the hell am I reading? Why is this a thing? It just really, it was terrible. Terrible times in comics back then. Like every hero became a backup character to the Avengers or to Maria Hill of S.H.I.E.L.D. There was that Indestructible Hulk run that was going on at that time where, like, Hulk couldn't, like, he couldn't wipe himself without clearing it with Maria Hill first. So terrible. I mean, they just made these heroes look so pathetic, like impotent. They had to just report to S.H.I.E.L.D. for everything, and it sucked. It really sucked. I don't really read enough Marvel right now to say whether or not that's changed. I've tried getting back into the Avengers, and I can't. I just can't. They got this weird, like, multiverse fetish, where I think they saw how the terrible Spider-Verse crap went, and it's like, okay, we need everything to have a verse. Here's the Black Panther verse. Here's the Captain America verse. It's like, can you just tell stories? Not everything has to be a first appearance of a derivative character that people can slab. Just tell us stories again, please. Oh, man. I wasn't expecting to go down that that tangent, but I guess maybe I needed to. Thank you so much for sharing your life and times in comics, Eric. I really appreciate it. I love hearing those stories because it's weird. They could be completely different from ours, or they can parallel ours, but there's always, like, some commonalities, you know? There's always a commonality where we can empathize or just relate, you know? Because I'm sure there are people listening who probably wanted to drop books at these times and didn't, or maybe they had already dropped them before these things happened. There's a lot of parallels there. But again, thank you so much for sharing, Eric. I really, really appreciate it. Next up, we got our friend Jody talking Asriel. And he says, I've been waiting for you to review these issues. It's been 25 years, but one of my only memories of No Man's Land was when it was originally released in my senior year of high school, were of my good friend Jason purchasing these issues, and Asriel in general, and remarking how absolutely awful they were. I'd say, why do you keep buying it if it's so bad? And he would say, it's so bad it has to be canceled soon. The joke was on him, as Asriel would last another 4 years and 51 issues. I would not experience these myself until my first reading in 2010, and he was absolutely right. Thank you for reviewing these so I didn't have to read them again. Oh, it feels like we're kicking poor Danny, doesn't it? But these issues were not good. Oh, boy. And you know, here's a little bit of a look behind the curtain here about how stupid a man I am. Last weekend, before all the plumbing stuff happened, I was at a used bookstore, and they have a 50-cent, like, wall. An entire wall of 50-cent comics. I have an educator discount, so I get 20% off anything I buy there. So my 50-cent comics are 40-cent comics now. So I'm in there. And I was looking for issues of Shadow of the Bat, actually, because I found so many issues of that there and I'd left them. So I was like, oh, you know, I'm in the area. I'll pop in there, see if I can find some of these Shadow of the Bat issues. And I couldn't. They were gone. But I did find a few issues of Asriel, and I bought them. I don't know. Why do I need this in my life? Why do I need Asriel number 18 and 22 in my life? For 80 cents, I guess, maybe. But I still bought them. I'll probably never read them. But, I'm a weak, weak individual. And I... it's silliness. Because they are not great. They're not great at all. And the thing of it is, like, I know this. But if I were to go back to that used bookstore tomorrow and there were, like, 5 more issues of Asriel, I'd pick them all up because I'm an idiot. But I want to thank you so much for the laugh there, Jody, because I remember the Joker's Last Laugh. You know, that crossover that was probably, what, 2001, 2002? And at that point, that was like... I can't remember if that came before Our Worlds at War. It was either Joker's Last Laugh or Our Worlds at War, which was like the first DC event that I jumped all in on. And I remember, like, for Joker's Last Laugh, it's like I'm buying books like Orion. You know, like, what the hell is this? And I remember buying Asriel, and I was just shocked that Asriel was still coming out. And, you know, in the years since, I've never heard anybody talk fondly about it. I don't know if I shared this story before, but I was buying a stack of Asriels for No Man's Land, and the guy at the counter is like, oh, you know, I just bought, or he said, years ago I bought the entire 100 issue run of Asriel on eBay for like $15, and I was like, oh, really? And he's like, yeah. He's like, I never read them. And he's like, and I think I overpaid. It's like, oh boy, I've never heard anybody say anything nice about this series. If anybody listening likes Asriel, likes this series, has an issue or an arc of Asriel that I need to check out that might change my mind, please let me know. Because I can't even imagine that there is one. So you let me know, and I will definitely check it out. I think that could be a fun little experiment. But thank you so much, Jody, for listening and for writing in. Next up, our friend Chris Yu, also talking about Asriel. He says, so, Batman was too busy to go to Washington, D.C. and protect Gotham's only friend in Congress. But as soon as this congressman gets killed, Bruce can just drop everything and run to D.C. to lambast Asriel for his failure. Seems like Batman shouldn't have farmed out this important mission to someone else. And that is true. Because it's like, I can't be there. Because it even that arc even started with Asriel getting, like, kind of snippy about, like, oh, you're sending me because I'm expendable. And Batman's like, yeah, kinda. And yet, here he is. He's able to just pop in and do the thing. And, I mean, we know Bruce is in Washington, D.C., so I don't know. Chris continues, I may have read this in the long ago, but I don't remember any of it. And I'm pretty sure that after the coverage of this storyline ends here in NML Crossing, I'm going to push everything out of my mind again. And that's probably for the best, because, yeah, like I said, I'm still not convinced that Nicholas Scratch exists. I think we might have all dreamt that. I think that's a shared delusion. We all need to check our carbon monoxide detectors here to make sure we're not, you know, popping synapses here and stuff, so I think that's got to be it. You know, I'm a denier of two things in the world. I'm a denier of Joni Loves Chachi. I refuse to believe that a show like that existed ever. And I think I'm a Nick Scratch denier as well. I don't think he's real. But anyway, Chris Yu continues. I'm happy that you give yourself these projects. I was talking about the methodology to these shows here. And how I wanted... I kind of wanted to put something together that would kind of define 2024 for me in my fake-ass, pseudo-creative kind of way, you know, outside of real-life responsibilities and stuff. I wanted to have a thing that would be like, okay, 2024 was No Man's Land, you know, and I picked it because it is so long. There's so many parts to it. We're going to cover the whole thing. It'll probably take 6-ish months. So, I mean, by the time we're done with it, the year will be already halfway over. And then we can go and maybe go into something else that I'm kind of putting the pieces together on. But we'll get there if we get there. But I had mentioned how I work best with projects. This being a project, other things I've done have been projects. So Chris is talking about that here. He says, I'm happy that you gave yourself these projects. Honestly, your projects have been my favorite parts of your blog and podcast. Action Comics Daily got me reading Chris's on Infinite Earths every day and anxiously anticipating the next day's post after finishing the current day's post. X-Men Vignettes is something I just went back and reread at the end of 2023 because I was missing your content. So I'm ecstatic to go on this journey of NML Crossing with you every Monday through Friday. And then on weekends, I go back and read comments left on Chris's on Infinite Earths. I even undertook my own project of reading the old Chris's on Infinite Earths blog posts in order from the very beginning several years ago. I still haven't finished yet. I lost my place when my old tablet died. Now, sometimes I say that, I repeat myself a lot, but sometimes I say, you know, there are letters that I get that I share with my wife, you know, that mean a lot to me and touch me. This one was one of them. Because I can't wrap my head around the idea that I add any sort of value to anybody's life. So, or entertainment or whatever. So to read this, it really affects me. And I can't even adequately put into words what it means for me. It really does mean a lot. I've said it before, and I'll say it again, probably, but this can be a very lonely thing to do, you know? People who actually write things, like writers, you know, authors, they say that it's one of the loneliest experiences or existences, because it's solitary. You know, you're doing the thing, you're by yourself, you're building your own worlds, but you're doing it alone. And this, in its own way, is kind of like that. You know, I'm talking to myself into a microphone right now. It's solitary, it's lonely. And so when you find out that you're not alone, it's pretty amazing and really hard to put into words, that sort of feeling. You know, and it's almost guilt. You know, I feel like I've hoodwinked people. You know, I've tricked you into listening to me, you know, or reading what I've written. That's just that silly imposter theory stuff or imposter syndrome or whatever it is. But yes, these projects are important. They help keep me motivated. And I love when people actually like catch on to the project and they stick with it with me. Action Comics Daily. I've talked about that one before as being a failure because I lost a lot of my readership. But that is really, that's missing the forest for the trees. Because during the year that we were doing Action Comics Daily, and for those who don't know, Action Comics became Action Comics Weekly from issue 601 to 640, maybe 641 or 642, I don't remember which. And so it was replaced with this weekly anthology, 6 stories in every single issue. So we would do one story every single day. And then at the end of the week, we would do a compilation post with everything in it. So you could follow along once a week and get everything, or you can just read along with us every single day. And that took 10 or 11 months to get through. And during that time, like I said, I lost a lot of readers, but I had some of the most wonderful conversations with people who stuck around and engaged, because there was a lot of good in Action Comics Daily or Action Comics Weekly, but there was also a lot of bad. It was, you could tell they were using it to try certain things out. Some of it didn't work. Some of it was particularly terrible. But, at that point in my content creation career, you know, fake-ass career, I was so wrapped up in the numbers that I couldn't enjoy what I had or even really appreciate it. But what it was this like fun little book club where we were just talking about the silliest stories, and it was a really good time, and it kept me motivated, and it had like a sense of urgency to it. Like I couldn't miss a day. I wanted to make sure everything, because everything was set out to like to the minute with that one. It was just such a big undertaking for such a small website. And I, at the time, nobody had done that anything like that before, and I'm pretty sure nobody has since. So, yeah, Action Comics Daily was pretty special, and I totally missed the point of it as I had it. It's like you don't know what you have until it's not there anymore. But I would, yeah, I it, if I had a year of Action Comics Daily again, I'd be very happy with that. Unfortunately, there's no such animal since we already did it. X-Men Vignettes, it was another fun one here. Now that is back when Marvel put out classic X-Men, like the reprints. What was it, 1986-ish? They started putting out the Claremont stuff again. They started with Giant Size and then into the Claremont run and through there for, I think that went like 110 issues or so. But for the first 44 or 45 of them, they all came with a backup story, like a story that fits into continuity, and it might tie into the story from the Claremont run. But these are stories that people don't really talk about all that much. So I thought it'd be a lot of fun to, put a little bit of a spotlight on them. So we did, 45 or so days of X-Men vignettes, where we looked at all these short stories and discussed them and saw how they tied in, or if they made sense, or if they didn't make sense, and had a really good time with that. That kept me motivated for, a couple months and or a month and a half, I guess. But that was an absolute blast. And our friend Chris Yu here, he hooked me up with a few of the books I was missing. Because back then, or even now in a way, I really only cover the books that I own physically. Because I like doing the ads. I like having all the back matter. I like to include everything I can. Anything worth discussing, I want to have as part of my piece. So he hooked me up with, I think, three or four issues that I was missing, which I didn't expect, and I'm sure I didn't adequately thank him either, because that was such a nice thing to do, such a vote of confidence in the silly stuff that I partake in, and it means the world to me, absolutely. And it means a lot to me anytime anybody goes back and reads anything on Chris's On Infinite Earths. The site is in kind of disarray since the move from Blogger to WordPress. I still haven't fixed it to how I want it. Yeah, so if anybody does go back on Chris's On Infinite Earths and finds like broken pages or something, let me know so I can fix them, because I have everything backed up. It's just a matter of, I mean, there are something like 3,000 comic reviews on that site. Yeah, I did it every day for 7 years. Or 6 years, many, many years, we did every single day a new story. Yeah, every time I would kind of get a wild hair about like getting back behind the microphone over during my little break or hiatus, I would pop in on the old Chris's on Infinite Earth stuff. Last June, I think it was, when I was doing the Sheehan Titans series, or trying to do a She and Titan series, I went back and I reread my coverage of some Titans issues. Like we went through Titans Hunt, the original Titans Hunt. We went through Total Chaos, and I remember reading those last summer as I was preparing to put together like a massive Titans themed project, and I was kind of taken aback at myself, because the words that I was reading came from someone who was clearly excited to be talking about what they were talking about. I was excited to be talking about what I was talking about back then, and I had just become so jaded and cynical in the interim that it sounded like a different human. Like, I couldn't believe that my words sounded so positive and so hopeful and just so excited to write about comic books. Because, you know, the past year and a half or so has been not great. It's been very, very dark for me, personally. So to see myself in a different light, it was totally alien to me. And it actually kept me from fully committing to doing the She and Titan show, because I didn't think I was the right vessel for it last summer. I was just in a very brutally dark place last summer, and last spring especially was not great. And I didn't want, because, you know, when you look at something you wrote and you realize it's there, like, forever, you know, and I want my voice and my words to be hopeful and happy and excited and just not negative, not jaded. And unfortunately, then my words were really not, they were not positive. I was a real asshole. And as I kept working my way through the archives at Chris's on Infinite Earths, my tone changed and it got darker and it got where it felt like what I was doing was a chore, because I made it a chore. And I wasn't enjoying it. And it was just, it was weird going from like that happy-go-lucky, just pleased to be here sort of voice to, okay, let's get through this. And I just didn't want to be that guy, you know? And that's part of why I stayed away for as long as I did. And I don't even know how I got to this in the conversation here. But, Chris Yu says he's been reading back the old Chris's on Infinite Earth stuff. So, if you see me get very cynical, if you can pinpoint where the worm turns in my excitement level, let me know. And of course, if there's any broken links, let me know that too, because I can fix those hopefully real, real quick. But I think that's where we'll leave it for now. Thank you, Chris, so much for this message. And I'm not lying. I did show this to my wife. It really meant a lot to me. Still, it means a lot to me. So thank you. Thank you so much. But that's where we will leave the mailbag for today. We still have plenty of letters to get to. We'll get to them in subsequent episodes, of course. But even though we do have a little bit of a backlog, I would like to invite anybody to write in. If you have anything you'd like to say or anything you want to talk about, anything about your comic collecting career, or, you know, hey, even these bat books, you know, let me know. You can find me all those different ways. Chris is on infiniteearths.com, of course, and weirdcomicshistory@gmail.com. All the social medias, I'm an easy fella to find. I've been sharing some of my Action Comics finds on Twitter X lately. I'm trying to get my full run of Action Comics back to number 400. Right now I need 10 issues from the 400s, and as I find them, I'm sharing them there with my road to 400 sort of gimmick. So you can find me there. I'm all over the place, and I hope to hear from you soon. But I think that's where we will end it for today. I think we're just shy of an hour. Oy, I'm sorry. I'm sorry for keeping you so long. But I would like to thank you all so much for sharing some of your day with me today. And until next time, as always, I'll talk to you again real soon. See ya. Makes it harder to think straight, stop.